Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, Pope Benedict renews his appeal for a stop to the violence in Libya and Syria. We'll have a report and speak to one Arab expert who gives his analysis of the events unfolding in the region. And a tip for summertime pilgrims ahead of the Marian Feast of the Assumption. We go to Rome's Basilica of St. Mary Major for a peek at the church treasures on exhibit in its very own museum. But first on the program, Pope Benedict is watching the events in Libya and Syria with growing concern. Once again, this past Sunday, he launched an urgent and dramatic appeal for an end to the violence that has engulfed both these nations as authorities seek militarily to crack down on protesters demanding freedom and democracy. Thousands have been killed and injured in both countries over the last 6 months. Eimear McCarthy has more.
Seguo con viva preoccupazione i drammatici crescenti episodi di violenza in Syria.
In a strongly worded appeal that came at the end of the Sunday Angelus prayer, the Pope said that he was following with great concern the dramatic and growing violence in Syria, which he said has caused numerous deaths and severe suffering.
Invito i fedeli cattolici a pregare.
The Holy Father invited Catholic faithful around the world to pray that efforts for reconciliation prevail over division and hatred. In addition, he renewed an urgent appeal to the Syrian authority and population for peaceful coexistence to be restored as soon as possible, and for an adequate response to the legitimate aspirations of the citizens, respecting their dignity and for the benefit of regional stability.
Nel rispetto della loro dignità. E a beneficio della stabilità regionale.
The Pope said his thoughts also go to Libya, where the force of arms has not resolved the situation.
La forza delle armi non ha risolto la situazione. Esorto gli organismi internazionali.
The Holy Father urged the international organizations and those who have political and military responsibilities to revive with conviction and determination the search for a peace plan for the country through negotiation and dialogue.
Attraverso il negoziato ed il dialogo costruttivo.
Voglio anche allo stesso tempo, con sua santità, con la sua voce così forte, chiamare.
Reacting to the papal appeal, the Melkite Greek Catholic Patriarch of Damascus, Gregoire III Lahamads, that the Christians in the country are not afraid of Islam, but rather of a chaos taking over similar to that in Iraq. The Patriarch also appeals to the international community, Europe and the United States in particular, to find a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian question, which he says is of greatest importance for the Arab nations in the region and the region's future.
Well, for more analysis on the situation in the region, Eimear McCarthy spoke to Jesuit scholar Samir Khalil Samir, a professor at Rome's Pontifical Oriental Institute and St. Joseph's University in Beirut. She asked him first why the international community has seemed so reluctant to engage Syria over its human rights violations, in stark contrast to its actions against Libyan authorities.
On one side, the international community was more interested in Libya, probably because Libya is rich in oil and because the attitude of the President Gaddafi was provocative in many times. The attitude of Syria is much more clever, but not better. There are some positive aspects, certainly, in the Syrian government, especially towards religious questions. Syria, since always, already in the time of the French protector territory, since the 40s, Syria was more religiously neutral, not Islamic country. And after the Ba'ath Party is a secular party. It was founded by a Christian and was adopted by Syria and Iraq. So for Christians, the situation, the religious situation is better for them than any other country except Lebanon. This was a positive point. Other things, Syria tried to make some reforms economically, but in fact, it was not very successful. What happens in Syria is that to maintain a regime which is in the hands of practically a family and a group, the family Assad and the group are the Alawites, who represent 11% of the population, the solution they adopted was to use control over the population. And this control was done through the intelligence service, the Mukhabarat, who were really those who controlled the country. Because of some advantages, because they controlled the Islamic movement, the West was supporting this regime and is still supporting. The Christians also, because they feel we are more secure with this regime than in any other. Even if there is no liberty and no respect of the human rights, and this is the other side of the question. Now, the reason why the West did not attack it is for these reasons, because really the government was so powerful that he forbade any Islamic movement. But this is not also a good solution. The country is mostly Muslim Sunnites. They have also the right to have their position, their points of view. So I think the position of the West and the position of the world in general was not right. It was very different from the reaction towards Libya and other countries.
You pointed out there that Syria is majority Sunni. The Alawites are, if I'm not mistaken, they have an element of Shia Islam, of the Shiites.
Well, it's a sect within Shia, a derivation of the Shia, but very different, in fact.
There are some observers who I've spoken to in the past who raise the issue of the outcome of these protests. If hypothetically Assad should step down, if there should be the end of the regime of the Assad family and the Alawites, that there would be created, and once again, the risk of a sectarian warfare within Syria. Often one other observer said the same thing that happened in Iraq, we could see happening in Syria, where the Christian community could become undermined. Is this a fear you would also have?
The risk is not so big like in Iraq. In Iraq, you had the Christian community was very small, less than 5%, 4%, something like that. The Shia were a little more than the Sunnah, but the Sunnah was governing. But the Sunnah was not a small minority like the Alawites, who are 11%. Christians in Syria are around 10%, Alawite 11%, and almost 80% Sunni. So the country is a Muslim Sunni tradition with a secular tradition also. I think that the situation now is impossible because of the violence. So whatever they do, there will be a reaction. But the people didn't want to make a revolution. They wanted simply more freedom, more justice, that not anybody could put someone in prison without any judgment. And this is the real situation of Syria. It's like in China. It's not better, maybe not worse, but if you try to make any opposition, you could go to prison or you could be beaten. It's not a bad regime for those, for instance, the Christians, who decided to remain quiet in political questions because they had security and an internal freedom, not the political freedom, and even any difference of view with the government. So we cannot support such a regime. In the Middle East, this kind of regimes are not abnormal, unfortunately. We don't know what means democracy. But this movement, which was called the Arab Spring, is exactly the opposite. People are asking to have democracy. They know through the television, the internet, and they know what means democracy in the world. They take Europe and America as models, not to imitate them in everything, but in the political democratical system, that the opposition has also the right to say its word, which is not possible in our countries, in Libya, Egypt, Tunisia, Syria, Saudi Arabia, and so on. Where we find this a little bit in Lebanon, but elsewhere we don't have it. In Morocco, it's the same system everywhere, in Algeria. So what is happening now since January is a large movement of the Arab world asking for a kind of democracy. And what is happening in Egypt with the trial of Mubarak is not a revenge against Mubarak. They are not asking to kill him. They want to judge these people, to say anybody could be judged, even for his acts, even if he is the president of or the king, or there is no difference. And this is a positive point. We have to move to this. We are not yet ready, I think. We are coming from at least 50 years of intolerance and domination of the people. And for me, it's a great hope, but it will not be easy to realize it immediately. It could take 10 years or a generation. But we have to. There is no other way. And this is, in my view, going in the Christian approach to politics. Now, it's not easy in politics to say, this is good, this is bad. Everything is mixed. But I think the line we have to follow is a non-violence line, but also the protection of human rights, of equality, of liberty, of thinking, speaking, and so on. Some aspects were good in the Syrian regime. The fact that there was no difference between religions and between groups, not totally, but partly. Other aspects are unacceptable. And unfortunately, the government and the president did not realize how strong was this movement. And when he saw such a strong movement against the authority, he reacted as his father reacted, as everywhere in the Arab world we reacted, with violence. This is a mistake. We cannot react with the army bombing and killing people.
Father Samir, we know that we have entered the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. What effect do you think this will have on the situation in Syria? Do you think it will weaken the protest movement there?
I have the impression that the protest is now so disappointed, and they will not stop. They are ready to die. This is something we have never seen. That the more they are killing people, the more people are protesting. That means we have reached a point where they say, it's enough. It was also, you remember, the name of this party created some years ago in Egypt and still working, Kifaya, which means enough, basta. This is the reality of most of our countries. So what I fear is that the Muslim movement could be stronger ideologically with the Ramadan, even if in fact the television, radio, and the media are totally controlled by the government, so that they cannot use this means, which is usually in Ramadan very, very strong Islamic. Probably the government will not allow any opposition. It could be that they are weak physically because of the fasting, and that they will not react. But I have the impression that they will go further, asking for liberty, dignity, and a change in the politics. My hope is that the government understands that these people are not anti-Syria and originally not against a group, but unfortunately, practically, they are becoming against the Alawites. Even if not, it does not mean that the Alawites were involved in the government, but they are part of a group, and this group is dominant and a minority group, and this dominance is becoming a dictature.
And thanks there to Jesuit Father Samir Khalil Samir, professor at Rome's Pontifical Oriental Institute and St. Joseph's University in Beirut. Have you ever wondered what happens to some of the finely crafted reliquaries, monstrances, and other objects used by popes and even saints in liturgical rites? It's not hard to imagine how many might be stuffed away in sacristy cupboards or displayed in areas where the public can't always see them. Well, the Basilica of St. Mary Major here in Rome has dusted off its collection of historic, liturgical, and artistic treasures for visitors to peruse at their leisure down in its crypt. Pope John Paul II himself inaugurated the museum on December 8, 2001. Here, besides the vestments and chalices of past popes, you'll even find relics from the life of Jesus, and something once held dear to the 17th century sculptor Gian Lorenzo Bernini, the designer of St. Peter's Square. Come with me on this, the first of a two-part tour of the museum. My guide, Professor Arnold Nesselrath, the Vatican Museum's curator with whose help the museum was first created. We started our tour looking back on that December day when Pope John Paul blessed the new museum beneath the Basilica of St. Mary Major. Professor Nesselrath, you were a consultant in this project of creating the museum. On the 8th of December, you were there when Pope John Paul came. You said the basilica was empty, and it gave a there was a real special feeling there when he was here.
The 8th of December, the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, is the traditional day of the year when the Pope visits the Basilica of Santa Maria Maggiore. So he goes to the Spanish Square and prays in front of the column, and then he comes.
The column with the statue of the Virgin Mary atop.
The statue of the Virgin Mary on top. And then he comes to Santa Maria Maggiore. So he drove into the courtyard, and the first thing he did when he got off his car, he blessed the museum from the entrance.
In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit of Son.
Amen.
And then he walked into the basilica, which was empty, which was lit with a splendid light. And in a very almost personal ceremony, he walked through the basilica. He visited the new holy door, which is only open during the holy year, which was newly installed. It was a very quiet, very moving ceremony.
St. Mary Major is one of the four patriarchal basilicas in Rome. The first church on the site was founded about the year 350 by Pope Liberius. According to tradition, the basilica was founded after the Virgin Mary appeared to a patrician man, revealing to him her desire that a church be built in her honour on Mount Esquilino. Pope Liberius is said to have received the same message in a dream. A miraculous snowfall on a hot summer day revealed the location which Mary had chosen for her basilica, also known as Our Lady of the Snow. Today, the legend is commemorated each year on August the 5th, when white rose petals are dropped from the dome during the liturgy. The original church was restored or possibly rebuilt by Pope Sixtus III in the year 432. In 1348, it was damaged by an earthquake and restored some years later. The basilica underwent a series of important additions and embellishments throughout subsequent years.
Now, why is a museum like this so important in the church for the faithful?
I think small museums in general are important because there are not only great works of art, but there are also other works of art that people should appreciate, and you have to get with these objects to many people. Now, in this particular case, it gives access to the treasures of the basilica. It really is the treasure of the church that is exhibited here, and it has an extraordinary success. So a lot of people come here. The comments are extremely positive.
The museum's guest book is filling up very quickly. Here's what one pair of British pilgrims wrote.
We were so interested to see the shirt of St. Thomas of Canterbury, as we're from Canterbury and saw it when this church lent it for the exhibition in Canterbury Cathedral. Signed Philly and Susan Cheatham on the 15th of March 2002.
People seem to be taking something away, an experience that they've made in this museum. Whether they're of Christian faith or whether they're not of Christian faith, they take a positive reaction back, and I think that's important, and it's something one really should build on.
Now let's talk about how the museum is laid out. It is beneath the basilica, where the crypts used to be.
Well, the stratigraphy of the basilica is very complex. It's built like all of Rome, but in particular the big Christian buildings, on Roman foundations. So it grew until the basilica was laid out by Sixtus III in the 5th century. And so the first section of the museum tries to give an idea of this building so people know where they are, know about how this place, how this site developed. There are pieces from the excavations underneath the basilica, an early Christian mensa from an early Christian altar. There are engravings, there are very beautiful miniatures showing the basilica, what it looked like in the 18th century. There is a reference to the King of Spain, who has a special relationship to this basilica. Every King of Spain is always a member of the chapter of the basilica. And then we're trying to inform the people of what the main relics are that are preserved here. The one is the famous portrait of the Madonna, according to the ancient legend, painted by St. Luke himself, then a relic of the Holy Cross, and then the wood from the manger in Bethlehem, which was brought here. They reconstructed a grotto, and then over the centuries built various reliquaries for it. So these are the main three sections in the first big hall. And then we are dealing with the many reliquaries that papal basilica site like Santa Maria Maggiore has, with wonderful objects designed by various goldsmiths over the centuries, amongst them the shirt of St. Thomas Becket.
St. Thomas Becket of Canterbury was born about the year 1118. He studied law and became Archdeacon of Canterbury in 1154. 1 year later, King Henry II made him Chancellor. In the position of Archbishop of Canterbury some years later, Becket openly opposed the king on a number of issues, including church loyalty to the Pope in Rome, eventually leading to his assassination in 1170.
This basilica always has an archpriest. We have a section on the archpriest. We have a section on the chapter with such important vestments as those of San Carlo Borromeo. But also up to the present day. Then we have monstrances, gifts to the basilica.
A monstrance is a vessel used for exposing the Eucharistic host for veneration. It often consists of a frame of golden or silver rays, in the centre of which is a receptacle with a glass window through which the host may be seen.
you get a very good overview over the goldsmith's work in Rome in the 19th century, and particularly in the lustrum, where you have all sorts of series of chalices which were either donated by the city of Rome. There was an annual gift. There are the ones donated by the archpriests, by the chapter, and also those given to single popes, like one by the Swiss, German and Austrian youth, given to Pope Pius XI in 1939, which I think is an interesting object to exhibit, especially for this period in history. And there is another one, equally important from a historical point of view, which is the one that the Archbishop of Canterbury gave to the first papal envoy to Britain in 1908, the first papal envoy who visited Britain after the schism of Henry VIII. So there are important objects together with important works of art, for example, like the chalice of the famous goldsmith Castellani, which was a discovery that was made while we were putting up this museum and which colleagues in the British Museum are very interested in.
What is the object that you would say shouldn't be missed? Why should I come to this museum? What is really stands out about it?
You should see the wonderful goldsmith reliquary produced for the year 1800 by Valadier.
Now that's the one we see almost as soon as we enter into the museum.
This is the one at the end of the big room, which was put together again, and it's used on the high altar of the Basilica now in its original form again. It was used in 2001 for the first time after many, many years, after a very long period, in its original form. That's a wonderful object. And then there is the spectacular image of the Madonna by Beccafumi, the great Sienese painter of the 16th century, contemporary of Raphael and Michelangelo. A wonderful, wonderful picture. There is the altar panel by Sodoma, and there are really all these vestments, like the vestments of donated by the Borghese, by the family of Paul V, with the cope, and very important vestments, also by Urban VIII. Then one should really see all the relics of St. Pius V, which were arranged, ordered by Pius IX, who had a special relationship to the Basilica and a special veneration for Pius V. Pope Pius IX, at some stage, had decided he wanted to be buried in this basilica, so he donated many objects to the basilica. He had a special veneration for St. Pius V, so he rearranged his relics, and we have his personal vestments and objects also in a kind of reliquary cupboard. Those are only a few of the objects that you really could see when you come.
And a warm thanks there to Professor Arnold Nesselrath of the Vatican Museums, instrumental in the creation of St. Mary Major's exhibits. And I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.